these daytime shows during the week that were part of an education program for the city schools, the public schools in the city, where they would bring kids into the spaces to watch the dress rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And because I knew, like, my dad was part of the performance and I could be back in the green room and, like, goofing off mm-hmm. after the show, I could also hear all of the performers react to how the kids were behaving in the space, mm-hmm. which was so boisterous, and there was talking and there was hooting and hollering and real reactions to funny things that happened, or, like, you know, of course, in tragic opera there's lots of stuff that happens,
yeah.
but the kids would react in these, like, visceral, loud, boisterous ways, and the people who were performing in the opera loved it. They were their favorite performances because they were actually getting something from, like, the call and response, right, that we, you know, sort of were listening to at the beginning. Like, they were getting that response that they needed, that energy that they needed.
Yeah.
So there's also something, I don't know, I keep thinking a lot about the vibration being energy
mm-hmm.
as well. And like you said, like, this idea that we're supposed to go into theater and just sit and watch and then leave makes it the opposite of what it used to be.
Yeah, completely.
Right.
Completely.
And much more similar, to sitting with our phones. Even movies, when I was a kid, movies and television, I always watched with other people. Mm-hmm. We never were watching TV on our own, and now we're always watching TV on our own. But I don't know how, to Alina's point, I don't know how you bridge the gap if it's ever it's always widening,
mm-hmm.
Which is sad.
Can you specify the gap, or, like, the gap between audience and performer?
Yeah, or just, the gap. And I feel like this is true. I'm more a visual artist, but I feel like this is true with visual art as well. Like, people just want to take a picture and move on, or take a picture and post it and move on. And that idea of sitting with something and having that rest that you were talking about, and really waiting for, I don't know, the listener's high or the viewer's high,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a runner gets a runner's high, that people just don't take that time. They don't know how to get over that.
Yeah, and it is a question of time. I mean, we had it in the talk of Danielle.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley was talking about that in her practice and talking about, that in so many exhibition spaces where the expectation is to be entertained, right? Mm-hmm. And so that so many viewers are hoping for this, like, real shift to, like, some kind of feeling. There's, like, expectation. But she creates these interactive installations. I don't know if anyone is familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley, she works with gaming and creates these interactive gaming spaces that are participatory and involve sound and storytelling.
Yeah, and she what I also found interesting is that she said a motivation for her to do that was, like, because her audience was so lazy. She realized that the audience in, like, art spaces is so lazy to perceive, and that that you almost do not get them to that point anymore without a certain frame of.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this and this is, I don't want to advocate for, like, the White Cube Gallery, who has, like, some very ephemeral photographies in it, and you should, like, immerse yourself in that. And this is, like, a very white, bougie understanding. But what we already had with that theater practice, for example, but and also, like, oratory, like, storytelling practices, we had a very, very beautiful artist guest person at the Academy of Fine Arts Nuremberg, who was invited by Sylvia Kiambi, and whose name I have to look up again, Ogutu, but I don't know the last name, made a storytelling performance with us, with like, I think it has been Yoruba techniques storytelling.
Mm.
And it was so much call and response in that. And you as the audience, you know, you have been comfortable in the room. And Ogutu was telling a story about like a colonial story, which then got like at some point a massive great release. And the thing that is happening is that as the audience, you get regularly called. Like, it's like, I think it was like, yeah, yeah, and then the audience answers, yeah, yeah. So that you're with them.
Mm.
They're just checking in that you're with them. You don't have to participate in the story, nothing. It's just a checking in, are you with me? And
yeah.
Then you respond, yes, I'm with you. And this, like, I realized, creates a really intense, it immerses you in a very different way than immersion in the overwhelming sense of, like,
mm-hmm.
there's so much in the room that you cannot escape it.
Mm-hmm.
That it just totally captivates you. It's not captivating you. You're very free in that and very in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the voice, the added voices become another texture
exactly.
in the space as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another act of disalienation.
Exactly. It's another act of practice of disalienation. Yeah. For moments.
Mm-hmm.
At least.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of inability to find joy in concentration or reception or whatever is also kind of helpfully complicating all these discussions around education
mm-hmm.
and bourgeois education
mm-hmm.
And how it's kind of maybe not necessarily the problem to kind of educate children in that way that they should go to the opera and enjoy, but they're also not educated to enjoy it, but kind of educated to sit silently. But there's also parts of this education is also, and I think seriously about kind of educating them or teaching them or showing them how to enjoy such things, and that it's not necessarily a problem of that, but of the conditions how these kind of education or this kind of enabling of enjoyment is unequally available to
mm-hmm.
different people, but
mm-hmm.
it's kind of there's often this, and I think I'm definitely also part of it, this kind of boredom or whatever, or like it's really easy to hate on these kind of modes of education, but I think there are parts of it that are really about finding joy in concentration
mm.
that are very necessary for people to kind of enable themselves to
mm-hmm.
find joy in things that aren't necessarily like easy consumption of stuff that eventually makes oneself sad.
mm-hmm.
How much, though, then, is the artist responsible for doing that education? Right, so if we're not getting that education anymore in our youth because technology is changing and we don't need to have that same kind of focus or concentration,
mm-hmm.
then how do we as artists, when we're asking for that from people, how much responsibility do we have to be also educators or to have that call and response to get them back
mm-hmm.
in? Or is that just then, you know, device?
Mm-hmm. Does somebody else want to engage in that first?
I think it's a decision that you as an artist will have to develop a practice of making this decision again and again. Because what you're up against is also, like, it's interesting the way that you've been using the word disalienation, because in my head, sound historically has been a source of disalienation because it comes from, I mean, not comes from a position of power, but, you know, there is somebody speaking in microphone and the rest listens.
Mm-hmm.
So history of church, polyphonic sounds, like there's an impact that, and the common man is supposed to listen, the one in power is supposed to speak. So like then you as an artist will have to like really dedicate a practice to it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In order to make people listen.
Yeah.
And it always depends on what artist you are and what you want from your practice. But I think it's very important to understand ourselves as artists, always as mediators. Like, we cannot get away from this. This is like also historically the place we are in, because like before art has been established as art. I mean, art has been like a life form, you know, it was like very socially embedded, and art became art through modernity. And in this, it has always been the education of the colonized and the education of like the bourgeois. Like, it has been very much part of the of making and forming white subjectivity as the status quo, like in all its forms.
When you say art became art, like what exactly does that mean?
Like the term art, you know, is not so old. Like an artist, you have artists and you have artisans also, like in the Middle Ages, medieval, blah, blah, blah. But they have always been like in charge of something. They have been like working for the church. They have been working like always in a very dedicated form, you know, for the king. And then the artist has not just painted paintings, but they also did build the interior. Like, they have always been in this more artisan thing.
Craftspeople.
Yeah, craftspeople problem. Yeah, and with modernity, the artist became like a separate autonomous figure. Like, art should become autonomous from this life embeddedment or implication, because it should be it should be a form of education. This was like the new thing, the new horizon art was directed to, and before it also has been an education, but it has been a very direct education of the senses.
This is rising at the same time as this idea of culture being nationhood.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's the building of the subject of the nation state.
Yeah.
I mean, art, A-R-T, as a English word, I believe, would be recent, but I mean, we made art when the first human being of our species put their hand, blood on their hand, on a wall. So, like, creative expression, I think, or cultural production, I believe, is way more primitive than...
Yeah.
Like, even researching history of, like, sound, and so, like, we were making, like, we as humans were making sounds on stones.
Exactly.
Before we did, I mean, at the similar time as we did, like, hands on caves.
Yeah.
So when you say, like, it's way too old?
Yeah, but we, as people who are in here and in this program, are working towards A-R-T, as in the English word that is involved in a capitalist system to some degree. We're not just joyfully making things on the side and then going about our peasant lives.
See, that is exactly what my question to Dread yesterday was.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because I believe we're working, like, we're making art and not A-R-T as in making art for the Western canon art. Like, putting art in the canon of history for the Western, so, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Art is more universal than that. I mean, this sounds very utopian, but I believe in that.
Yeah, probably I would say there comes the question of need in it, because, like, you know, people had a certain need to put their hands on that wall, to leave a trace, to leave, like, they're like very, a lot of needs of origination or stuff like that in these art practices and forms. But, yeah, that's why I think a huge question also on that fantasy conference probably is, or leaves us with as artists again and again, is like, is it going to be art what we are producing when we want to, like, form a liberating practice out of it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. or like which other form, like, you know, can art stay art? And not in the sense of like we will do like channeling the creative spirit, which is like mm-hmm. the most important thing ever. I think in a human's life it's super important to have and to establish this and to challenge this also in terms of education, but not in the art as like the Western program of art. And I get what you mean. I mean, you're on the right side of things, in my opinion.
I hope so. But also, like, what
that's
I'm getting
why we
is
talk.
That, like, that what the argument here is that art, as in, sorry, I've lost my train of thought.
But
not the, like, we're going against the institutional validation of the art when the form of art takes more diverse forms,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, when it's more diverse
yeah.
than what we have already, like, set as, oh, this is art. Like, massaging somebody with a transducer, which is a work that I recently learned about, and I love it. I'm sure that you've heard of it, like massage through a transducer.
Yeah.
So like that, 10, 15 years ago, no, 20, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't be art,
mm-hmm.
I would say. But
yeah.
now it is. So like, that, is that the
right.
argument, right?
Right, but then also, why did it become art? Art. Art. Why did it become art?
Art with a capital.
Why does art evolve to collect and swallow all these different forms that are then what sellable, available in a gallery? Like, what is
that? Is I find your curiosity about education very interesting, because how do you
but that's why I'm working through it just like you,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's the question of, and I think maybe what did Dredd say yesterday in response?
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, well, you can go somewhere else. You can go to London.
Yeah.
You can go. And I didn't like that answer. And
it was a little naive, yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't seem to really be answering what you were asking. But my question would be, like, to your point of if we're trying to liberate, or if we're trying to mediate and inform or just give some what we have made to others, like, what form does that take? And sometimes I think that doing that through the institutions reaches more people, and
yeah,
that's okay.
100%.
And then sometimes I think that just handing someone you love something that you
mm-hmm.
created out of your creative spirit is also that too, and I would consider that art.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's a whole other level which has to do with class,
mm-hmm.
like you were saying,
capitalism.
And taste.
And yeah. And feeding yourself, you know? And some people have the means and the time to make work and never sell anything
mm-hmm.
or never make it to any level where they can get a grant or anything. And some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are different. Like,
mm-hmm.
the options for people are different
mm-hmm.
all over the place, all over the globe.
Yeah, it's a question of work that comes in very significantly. It's the question of if we want to go there right now, I think, or I would highly recommend, if you're interested in these questions, to come to Marina Wischmidt.
Marina Wischmidt?
Mm-hmm, I can write it down for you. You can share it. Who was a theorist who just recently sadly died,
mm-hmm. Thank you.
But wrote a lot about these infrastructural questions and like around the question of how did art came into play of this nation building subject
mm-hmm.
and what it has to do with work on a very material life basis. So that's very important, and I think like it doesn't come I mean, of course, it comes when you talk about sound. I think sound as a medium, or like as a form of mediation or relation, complicates things very differently than image producing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you find this in every. You can find like, and I think it's also very specific that we immediately came to disalienation as a term, because you can find this through like, and it's a term. Maybe good to say which is very shaped by Frantz Fanon,
yes,
as like a decolonial practice.
Mm-hmm.
Or like which Frantz Fanon said, this is the only horizon, which is the liberating horizon of the white and the black subject. Mm-hmm. And thinking like about disalienation as the horizon of our practice, and also about disalienation as the horizon of our forms of education we want to use, just shapes our practice very instantly. And then it may be, I mean, it will be harder and harder to do that in the institutions at the point we're at right now. So to think about how we want to establish this in our art practice and integrate it in a social context is probably a very necessary and interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun kind of following along, because like, I feel like one sort of way for me to frame how I'm listening to this conversation is like my relationship to this institution and this space, because I was a music major here
mm-hmm.
5-6 years ago. And now I'm most active in very DIY, like underground experimental spaces, and like I've like kind of found like an ethos and like of abundance in those spaces, which is sort of, there's this undercurrent of scarcity because we don't have money, so
mm-hmm.
in some way, not entirely, it becomes that it's not about money in some way. Sometimes, ideally. and I think usually that enables like a sort of feeling of abundance, like you can play anything, you can
mm-hmm.
yeah, really play anything in any space, any sound system,
mm-hmm.
and like and I think there's something really liberating there. And I think where I am currently is like, as I'm trying to extract my financial independence from food service, I'm like, oh, is there money in like creating, you know, like, so I labeled like a sound artist, which like
mm-hmm.
I'm like kind of like, that feels kind of accurate. I like just saying that I do things with sound because that feels more honest.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, my like relationship around institutions and money, I think I'm like trying
mm-hmm.
to not have such a binary like antagonistic relationship to it. And okay, and another thought I had was like how I think finding this sort of more like DIY ethos around sound, one way that it's inspired me as well as starting to field record is feeling like you can be immensely creative just by how you listen in like
mm.
any space, like really any space ever. I find one of the most disorienting things is to listen in a crowded room, like say before a concert, before an event, for anything, just like just trying to catch, it's almost like listening to water, you know,
mm.
but like
mm-hmm.
it's more disorienting because you actually want to like hone in and trace the voice. But yeah, I just felt like there was so much coming up like in this conversation. I really
mm-hmm.
enjoyed listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
I am as equally disappointed that in the three opportunities that the ICJ has had in order to call for the cessation of all hostilities has failed to do so explicitly. It's not like genocide continues in Gaza because the ICJ didn't go far enough. No, political hurdles would still be there. It allowed for weapons sanctions, like ones that were placed against Israel by Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, and Colombia. It allowed countries to cut diplomatic ties with Israel, like Bolivia and Brazil. It allowed for the initiation of criminal cases under universal jurisdiction in other national courts. And more than anything, above all, it allows us to continue to isolate the U.S. and Israel. They can do what they're doing, but they're doing just through brute force without any legitimacy.
That's Noura Erekat, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noura Erekat on international law. Real or fiction? After the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine, the term international rules-based order would be repeated by Washington officials almost daily to describe Moscow's action. Then a curious thing happened when Israel invaded Gaza in 2023. The term virtually disappeared as the U.S. sought to protect its close ally, Israel. The U.S. itself, over the decades, has a long record of violating the international rules-based order with its invasions, occupations, coups, assassinations, and sanctions. A compliant corporate media consistently fails to point out this brazen hypocrisy. Since the leader of the so-called free world and its allies are not held to account, the rules-based order is in total disorder. From Washington's perspective, the rules are for thee, not for me. Our guest today is Noura Erekat. She's a human rights attorney and a professor of Africana Studies in the Program of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University. She's the author of the award-winning book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. She spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. And now, Noura Erekat, International Law, Real or Fiction?
Thank you to all of you. I'm actually thrilled to see as many of you in this room as possible after what most of us teach in the classroom in the field of third world approaches to international law. So much of what we do and try to animate in the classroom has come to vivid life in the course of the past 11 months, where the world has become our textbook in understanding what is the law, what is it doing, what is it not doing, what potential does it have, can it be useful for our emancipatory struggle, is it only a site of oppression, when we use it, are we actually legitimating it to the point where it is actually causing us more harm than good? And I think all of these questions that we ask have been animated in this particular moment. The first question I want to address is international law real? Is it a thing or is it a fiction? Given the fact that it has not been able to stem one of the worst colonial genocides that we've seen in our lifetime, where we have been told that we have never seen starvation happen at this rate, where we have never seen the devastation of buildings, the amount of buildings that have been destroyed in Gaza in the past 11 months. It took in Syria 4 years to destroy an equivalent amount. We have never seen this many children slaughtered and killed as we've seen in the past 11 months than we've seen across almost all conflicts in the past 7 years. It's the rate, it's the intensity, it's the vision of it. And yet here we have all of these structures of law that have been unable to stem what is unequivocal right before our very eyes. What's happening? Surely it can't be these vapid talking points. Surely it can't be that. And so the first question I want to ask attempt to answer is the law real? The second question I want to address and answer is, so what's going on? What happened at the ICJ vis-a-vis genocide? What is the Genocide Convention? What are its limits? What is its potential? And similarly, what's happening at the International Criminal Court? What is its potential? What are its limits? Is there anything to be gained from this place? And then finally ask, what about U.S. federal courts? Because we know that the Center for Constitutional Rights also brought a lawsuit within federal courts in the Ninth Circuit and then at the appellate level, and now is still going up for appeal based on the urgency of the question. And then the last question I want to try to answer is, so what do we do now, if anything, with the law? I know my moniker includes that I'm a human rights attorney, but I am very, very clear and explicit that we should have no fidelity to the law. Zero. It is a form and function of power. To the extent that we ever use and leverage it, it's not to believe in it, that it has any kind of noble inherency, but instead to approach it with strategic acumen in order to leverage it for our purposes when possible. Okay, and I'll get to that. So first question, is international law real? The easy answer is no. Hard to believe that it is. And frankly, if the law were to do what we think it's supposed to do, we wouldn't be at 75 years of settler colonial elimination. Like it would have, we didn't need this moment to sow the doubt for us, for those who are particularly concerned with Palestinian liberation, to know that the law isn't doing, if it's supposed to be doing, it isn't doing what it's supposed to do. It has not stemmed the Nakba. It has not stemmed settler colonial expansion. It has not stemmed even settlement enterprise, which should be the lowest hanging fruit. It has not stemmed the acquisition of territory by force, even where it's not controversial. Why would I say it's controversial in Palestine? Because there are many legal arguments. I won't get into too many of them, but the basic legal argument that had been advanced since 1967 is that unlike the other territories that were occupied by Israel in the aftermath of the 1967 war, the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, that the West Bank and Gaza, unlike these territories, did not have a sovereign. That the Palestinians were not a people, and therefore you could not return the land to a status quo ante because there was no sovereign that existed. This is the missing reversion or argument. And so instead, the argument has been that this is disputed territories. Even if anyone believed that was compelling, which it absolutely isn't, but even if you believe that was compelling, we just saw in what, I think it was in 2019, Israel explicitly annexed the Golan Heights, where the Syrian sovereign was never in question or in dispute, and yet we saw an explicit acquisition of territory by force and absolutely no repercussions. Again, if the law were to do what it's to do, we did not need this horrific moment in order to sow doubt for us that it's not doing what it is. All right. But the easy answer is that obviously it's not. And the reason that it doesn't work is because there's no enforcement mechanism in the international legal system, that, you know, there isn't what we have. The closest thing to an enforcement mechanism is the Chapter 7 authority of the Security Council, which is the only body that can authorize the use of force over another country or several countries. And yet what we know about the Security Council is that it is also characterized by the permanent 5 members. There are 15 members of the Security Council. 5 of them are permanent. They have a veto power. 10 of them are alternating and serve for 2 years at a time. And any one of those 5 members can undermine the will of the entire international community. And the U.S. has done that consistently, systematically, in order to protect Israel. And the only other countries where there is even something close that approximates the systematic nature of the use of this veto on the international level has been the U.S.'s use of the veto to protect apartheid Southwest Africa, currently known as Namibia, and South Africa, which we know as the Republic of South Africa. So veto powers, 5 permanent members. So if we know that the only place to have enforcement mechanism is in the Security Council, and the Security Council is characterized by this embedded flaw, then the law will never be able to do what we want it to do. It can neither regulate how states behave, nor can it punish states' transgressions. But if that were true, then we would have seen an all-out revolt against the law. And we haven't seen that because the law is doing something even for the weakest states and even for even in the service of emancipatory struggles, including for the Palestinian struggle. And that moment came when Palestinians actually used it quite effectively, not in this moment, I would argue, specifically in the 1970s. In the aftermath of the October 1973 war, when Egypt and Syria attack Israel, lose the battles in what's known as the October 1973 war, but win the war in demonstrating that they can actually undermine Israel's security, it recalibrated the balance of power in the Middle East and actually ushered what we know as the Middle East peace process. What Professor Abdelrazzaq Al-Takriti yesterday was talking about of the disaggregation of the Arab-Israeli struggle, which becomes instead now the Lebanese-Israeli struggle, the Syrian-Israeli struggle, the Egyptian-Israeli conflict, struggle is not the word, they use conflict, Egyptian-Israeli conflict, the Jordanian-Israeli conflict. It was disaggregating the question in order to weaken each of them as a collective and to drop Palestinians out of the bottom altogether. In that moment, in order to recalibrate their position, the Palestinian Liberation Organization wants to enter the United Nations, does so because they couldn't enter the peace process, enters the United Nations in 1974, and establishes itself in two General Assembly resolutions, which, unlike the Security Council, is not an imposing body of law. In that moment, passes two Security Council resolutions where they establish that they are the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. In doing so, they overcome their juridical erasure, which was established in the Balfour Declaration, which says that never recognizes Palestinians as a political people with the right to self-determination, but instead recognizes them as a religious and civil minority with certain rights. So they overcome this erasure by establishing that here is a people with a land, with a leadership, and the right to self-determination, and reinscribe themselves juridically. But that's a catch-22 as well, because in doing so, they're also subscribing to the very bodies of law that also recognize Israel as a political fact, that has also recognized the normalization of Nakba. Right? There's a gamble there, but they're using it politically. The other resolution that they pass, it's 3236 and 3237, is equally very strategic in that it gets around Resolution 242. The language of Security Council Resolution 242, which is passed in November 1967, some 6 months after the 1967 war, basically establishes a quid pro quo arrangement whereby all the territories that Israel has occupied will be returned to their rightful sovereigns in exchange for permanent peace. It's a promise for normalization agreements. But in that language and that agreement, it was very much considered by the PLO an instrument of defeat. But it was passed unanimously in the Security Council, including by Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt. But what happens is that it's worse than we think on its face, because Palestinians in that resolution are not recognized as a people, but only described as a refugee problem. And so here too, the requisite remedy will only be some humanitarian assistance to a people who don't need charity. They are asking for political power, demanding it, deserving it. What they do in 1974 in these resolutions 3236 and 327 is not just reinscribe their juridical status, but simultaneously reconstruct a definition of self-determination that overcomes the strictures of 242 and says that they can engage in negotiations, but on a path that won't recognize Israel as a political fact. If the law were only to serve the powerful, Palestinians would not have been able to achieve that. The very next year, right after this in 1974, this is the year where we're also seeing in 73 the legislation of apartheid as a crime against humanity. And the purpose for doing that is really to isolate the apartheid regime of South Africa, which is another legacy of the League of Nations mandatory system, as is Palestine. But in that situation, the mandatory power never leaves, never evacuates, and instead seeks to settle and remain as the settler sovereign. In Afrikaner identity. South Africa is not, apartheid is not merely racism on steroids. Apartheid is colonialism that is explicitly racist. It was known by the Communist Party as a peculiar kind of colonialism, even though more recently the liberal interpretation of apartheid really understands it as a peculiar kind of racism. Which is why so many people get angry that you would call Israel as an apartheid state, because they're like, no, that's not enough. We don't want equal rights. We want to decolonize. Yeah, but apartheid and ending apartheid is decolonization in the radical tradition of it. And so in 73, this idea of the move by now what is becoming a third world majority of newly liberated states and national liberation movements, they are now using their automatic majority in the General Assembly to create new law. And they create the apartheid convention to declare it a crime against humanity. In that same spirit, the next year, the General Assembly unseats South Africa from the UN. When it is led by the Algerian foreign minister, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who has now come to preside as the president of the General Assembly, right, in the aftermath of Algeria's victorious independence movement and revolution, and the Security Council says you can't unseat South Africa. In fact, not only do they say you can't unseat South Africa, they say you're being too extreme. Don't alienate the South Africans. We have to bring them along in a peace process. And because the Security Council has the exclusive power of who is and is not a member of the United Nations, and the Security Council, as we've already covered, is rife with this flaw, what the General Assembly does under the helm of Bouteflika is to change the rules altogether to make it within the General Assembly purview of you, we won't decide who's a member, but we'll decide who gets to be seated. And they unseat South Africa. And the PLO, right? This is just about using the law strategically. The PLO in that spirit then says, right, let's go. We're about to unseat Israel. And then use 75 as the year that they're going to do that. And in the summer of 75, they attend multiple international conferences for this purpose. They attend the International Conference on Women in Mexico. They attend the Non-Aligned Movement Conference in Peru. They attend the Organization of the Islamic Conference in Jeddah. They attend the African Union Conference, then known as the Organization of the African Union Conference in Uganda, in Kampala, Uganda. And in each, these are all allies. And in each of these forums, the only one where they successfully get a resolution to unseat Israel was at the OIC in Jeddah. Who blocks the resolution in Kampala, and who blocks the resolution at the NAM? None other than Egypt. Because Egypt at that time is now in direct bilateral negotiations with Israel, overseen by the United States, to recoup the Sinai Peninsula through negotiations. And in that moment, they basically say Egypt, in its interest, doesn't want to alienate the United States, which they believe is the only power that can deliver the Sinai back and facilitate this. And so the compromise that comes up at each of these conferences, short of unseating Israel, is declaring Zionism as a form of racism. Everyone's in agreement. And the Organization of African Union is very explicit that their liberation is entwined with Palestinian liberation, that Zionism, like white supremacy and like other racist ideologies, is a threat to world peace. And so by the time they get to the General Assembly in 75, what the PLO does in conjunction in the third committee with this third world majority is they are about to, because they can't unseat Israel, instead what they do is they are building on what the international community is doing to isolate South Africa, which is basically launching a world conference against racism, the Decade Against Racism. In the move to launch the Decade Against Racism, it basically declares that all forms of colonialism are racism, occupation, and apartheid are illegitimate and forms of racism. And what the Palestinians do, led by Palestinian scholar, activist Fayez Sayer, does in this moment is to amend the resolution to insert Zionism everywhere the words apartheid and colonialism appear. And this becomes a huge battle. I detail it all if you're interested, looking at that diplomatic history in a book chapter. But the outcome of it is that they passed Resolution 3379 in November 1975, declaring Zionism as a form of racism and racial discrimination. A major victory. Well, if the law only served the powerful, Palestinians couldn't have done that. And if you're wondering, well, what happened? It was the PLO that rescinded that resolution in 1991 as a precondition for entering into the Oslo Agreement. They not only rescind, I'm shocked that this is shocking. I must be very old. So they rescind that resolution. Not only do they rescind that resolution, but they also amend their PLO charter that says that they do not have a right to armed force. They basically, you know, reneged on all of their possible leveraging power in exchange for recognition and then to be put in this trap that we're in right now. One more example, if I've not compelled you enough, comes in 1977 when the PLO works with this third world majority, works with newly independent states, works with national liberation movements who are engaged in anti-colonial warfare to amend the laws of war. So as the laws of war are constructed, in the beginning as they're constructed, they're primarily constructed in a way that excludes the entirety of the global south. Warfare, civilization, humanity is limited to the global north very explicitly, to Europe and European, you know, adjacent. So when laws of war are being developed very explicitly as well, the global south is excluded from the category of civilian. They're not recognized as civilians, but they're also excluded from the category of combatant, from the category of being able to be a soldier with the right to fight. And what happens is we have the 1949 Geneva Conventions that follow the Second World War that basically legislate. Now we see a robust legislation of the laws of war that give us the four Geneva Protocols, right? The four Geneva Conventions, I should say, right? The first convention on the rights of the wounded and the sick on land, the second on the rights and the wounded of the sick at sea, the third on the prisoners of war and how we recognize prisoners of war, keeping them alive, the rights that they have. They shall not be tortured. They shall not be starved. They shall be treated well. There should be no information extracted from them until they are returned. And the fourth Geneva Convention on the rights of civilians who are occupied. But what doesn't get included and is not factored in is that the most significant warfare to take place between the Second World War through the 1960s will be national liberation warfare. And for the most part, now there's an open debate. How do we regulate this warfare where there is no formal army? This is not conventional war between two states. So how is it recognized? The United States is adamant, along with Israel, that any civilians who are taking part in war are terrorists and criminals. Adamant. And they're not alone. But certainly because of what we're seeing across the global south, this is Angola, this is Mozambique, this is South Africa, this is Cape Verde. We're seeing it, you know, of the different various peoples who are rising up for their independence. We see a global majority that basically legislates the first and second additional protocols, recognizing guerrillas as soldiers with the right to fight, which recognizes specifically and anticipates that war will be conducted in densely urban areas, that recognizes that civilians and guerrillas will not be easily distinguishable and how to distinguish them, that recognizes that civilians will bear the highest cost if there is no distinction. And so passes Article 51, that first additional protocol that stipulates that in a situation where you cannot anticipate or cannot reduce the harm to the civilians, even if it's the fault of the adversary, that military operation shall be ceased. Those are the laws of war that are legislated in 77. So two notes on that. The first is what you think I'm going to say, which is if only the strong can pass laws, we wouldn't have had that. I hope I've made that point clear. The second point I want to make is you are being gaslit when you are told that Israel's confrontation with Palestinian militants is unprecedented. When you are being told the talking points about tunnels and human shields and the rest of it, That is actually the primary mode of warfare since the Second World War. This is not unique. It's just out of time and place. There is all the laws in order to regulate this particular form of warfare. And Israel is not alone. The U.S. tried to do the same thing when it established Guantanamo Bay and kidnapped Afghan, Pakistani, Somali, Filipino civilians and couldn't tell the difference and held them incommunicado and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the U.S. had jurisdiction and tried to say that none of the laws of war applied, including the Third Geneva Convention, that would have given them the right as prisoners of war and the right to be treated humanely. So Israel's not unique. I also don't want to make this argument that, oh my God, nobody's ever done this. In fact, everybody's done this, and especially the government that represents us. So back to the point. That was my long point to explain that the law couldn't just be fake, which you all kind of unanimously told me that it was. Because if it was fake, then how? How did we achieve so much? And I should note that the U.S. and Israel have been outstanding objectors of the first additional protocols and have never signed on to it. So there still is that complication. But on the other hand, we know that the law is not doing what it's supposed to do. That's kind of where we started. So if there were imagine there is a spectrum, and this is in the legal literature and the kind of legal theory debate. If there is a spectrum, and on the one side you have the positivists that really argue that we should study the law as a science to understand what it means and says, and just look at the text in order to give you an interpretation, and that's what it is, we would describe them in the words of Marty Kuskaniemi as the utopians, right? This is utopia. And we all at least can agree that's not real. And I haven't told you anything to take away from that. On the other hand, at the other side of the spectrum are the Marxists as well as the right, who insist that the law is a political fiction. And in the words of Richard Falk, who would describe it, who actually was much more of a positivist anyway, would describe it, it's basically a club with which to beat the weak. And I'm not saying that they're wrong. By observation, they are correct. But what this position leaves, really, in what Marty Kuskaniemi would describe as an apology for power, and it leaves out this entire potential of what people do and how they can do it using the law without being dictated by the law. This is movement lawyering, and it happens in your community, and it certainly happens on the international level. The way that I would describe it is to then say, if we are to use the law for our emancipatory purposes, we have to use it in the sophisticated service of movement. In that way, this is an analogy that I put out. Think of the law like the sail of the boat, and think of politics like the wind. If you're in a sailboat without a motor, you can only move in the way that the wind blows. And so I encourage us to pull up the sail when the winds are blowing in our direction. That's political movement. When it's blowing in our direction, pull up the sail, it's going to blow us where we want, and the law can help us. Draw the sail when the winds are blowing against us. When the balance of military, economic, social, moral authority is against us. And when you have the opportunity, make a whole new sail, to pivot it in a way where we can move where we need, as our predecessors did in 74, 75, and 77, by way of example. All right? The second question I was asking, what about the current landscape and how we can understand it? Let me answer the ICC question really quick first. Let me first start by saying that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is distinct from the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice is the principal organ of the United Nations. Every member of the UN is subject to the ICJ, to its advisory opinions, as well as to its contentious decisions when they submit to it. An advisory opinion is an opinion that the court is telling us what they think the law is. In a contentious suit like South Africa brought against Israel, now it's binding. In distinction, the International Criminal Court is a product of treaty. What is a treaty? It is an international contract. And as with all contracts, you don't have to abide by it. You have to agree to it by ratifying the treaty. This international treaty is the Rome Statute that's legislated in 1998, and it doesn't come into effect until 2002 when a requisite number of states sign onto it. In 2002, now we have the ICC. The ICC outstanding objectors, are you shocked? Who is not a member party of the ICC? Okay, Israel, but also? Us! The United States is not. In fact, the largest country that is a member of the ICC is Brazil. And three of the five permanent Security Council members are not part of the treaty at all. So imagine that, notwithstanding the fact that the Security Council is one of the three forms of establishing jurisdiction at the ICC. What does that mean? That means that there's three ways to get a case in front of the ICC. One of them is through, you know, the Office of the Prosecutor can decide. And one of them is that the Security Council can actually ask and transmit something to the ICC. But if that is a form of jurisdiction, and yet three, they have the authority to relay a case to the ICC, but three out of the five are not members of the ICC, you already know something's wrong. But now look at the ICC, look at the Rome Statute's actual stipulations. And I'll just give you a couple. Okay, one of them is this, what I was telling you. I think this is Article 13 on jurisdiction. But another one is also Article 17 on complementarity. And complementarity basically establishes that if a state's court system is adequate and can prosecute its own, it has the right of first jurisdiction. So that means that any country that wants to prosecute its own soldiers, say, for example, for their war crimes, that will trump the ICC authority to try that particular state. Who can make that argument and who can't? Very obvious and very clear. It's mostly going to be